Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Hey, everybody, we got a great one for you today. You know, for a change, Franklin Four of the Atlantic is back. Over the last several months, Frank has written a number of terrific articles about anti-Semitism at Columbia and Harvard, and how the Trump administration is using these claims as an excuse to go after the elite left-wing colleges, which it hates. I originally planned for this to be the focus of our discussion, but with the famine in Gaza, I had to make sure that we discuss that as well. So the serious subject of anti-Semitism at our elite colleges turned into a tragic discussion of Israel's culpability for starvation in Gaza. In March, Israel froze all food aid to Gaza for 6 weeks. They then restored some, but only a little, and did it so chaotically that Israeli soldiers shot and killed over 1,000 Gazans who were desperately trying to get food. I have been a Zionist since I can remember, and these images made me sick. As Frank argues, Israel needs to work with the U.S. and the U.N. to flood Gaza with food. But now, Netanyahu is doubling down in saying that Israel is starting a new offensive against Hamas. His security cabinet has announced its plans to take control of Gaza City. While this isn't as terrible as Netanyahu's intention to control the entirety of the Gaza Strip, it is still explicitly going against the Israeli military's own recommendations. This expansion of the war is only going to add to the atrocities we're already witnessing. We'll be right back with Frank Ford. Frank, thanks for joining me.
Great to be here.
Now, in the last few months, you've written 3 articles for The Atlantic about anti-Semitism at Columbia and Harvard and the loss of civil discourse at both institutions and the cynical use of that by the Trump administration to punish left-wing academy. Now, there was anti-Semitism on these campuses, but a lot of what people were calling anti-Semitism was actually, they would say, anti-Zionism, and attacking Israel for its actions in Gaza and on the West Bank, and equating the war in Gaza with genocide. And the starvation of Gazans has given credibility to that claim. So let's start by discussing that.
Okay.
You just dropped a new piece today in The Atlantic, a piece called Israel's Last Chance, about them addressing this famine that's going on in Gaza.
Right now, Gaza is on the brink of mass starvation. And what's so troubling about this is that it's not a consequence of war, not a consequence of the brutalities that come with that war. It's the consequence of a series of policies that the Netanyahu government has pursued. The first of those policies was that in the beginning of March, it imposed a blockade on all goods coming in to Gaza.
For about 6 weeks, there was no food coming in at all, right?
That's right. And then when that blockade was lifted under international pressure, instead of returning to the system where the UN was primarily responsible for coordinating a network of NGOs and had its own infrastructure for bringing in aid, it turned to something called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
Israel turned to that, yeah.
Israel turned to it, which is this hastily designed, improvised system that they built in conjunction with the United States that relied on a plan that was designed by management consultants, private security contractors, presided over by an evangelical chair.
A disaster.
It was a disaster. It was a disaster. It was a disaster for two reasons. The first is that the UN has so much expertise about how to deal with humanitarian crises caused by conflict. They rush into almost every humanitarian conflict in the world. They don't just tend to the problem of hunger. They deal with hunger in the context of every other need, whether it's water sanitation, whether it's providing fuel to be able to cook food, and it deals with nutrition because people who have gone hungry for an extended period of time
can't eat certain stuff. They can and have to eat other kind of stuff,
and they become highly susceptible to disease. That's their greatest vulnerability. And then the second reason that this was disastrous is because the UN had 400 outposts that it was using to distribute aid.
All over Gaza and northern Gaza, and the U.S. thing was in just four locations in southern Gaza, right?
Exactly, in areas that the Israeli military controlled, which meant that people in the north obviously were not being served by this. But it also meant that people even in the more densely concentrated population centers in the south were forced to come across distances into a complex that was controlled by Israeli soldiers, and they were extremely hungry. And it meant that you had mobs often coming through these outposts, and you had terrified soldiers, and it was a recipe for catastrophe, for combustion. And there are hundreds of Palestinians that the Israeli military killed in the course of poor, hungry people merely trying to get something to eat.
That is an atrocity.
It is. Throughout this war, there are a lot of things that one could go back and forth about the ethics of. And it is a truism that any war that's fought in dense urban conditions is going to be extremely brutal. But, I think that there needs to be a bright line drawn where a policy of imposed deprivation that goes beyond, it passes every ethical red line and deserves universal condemnation.
Now, the anti-Semitism on these campuses and maybe calling it, anti-Israel or anti-Zionism, does the starvation of Gazans given credibility to their claim?
Okay, I think we need to be clear on certain terms here. So there's criticism of Israel itself, criticism of the Netanyahu government, and I would argue that there's nothing remotely anti-Semitic about that, and it's not even necessarily anti-Zionistic, right? That there are people, and I would put myself in this camp. I believe in the state of Israel's right to exist. And I find the policies of the Netanyahu government in the course of prosecuting this war to be something that totally, eminently, not just worthy of protest, but in many instances demands protest. But there are places where I think that the protest of the war crosses the line into not just anti-Zionism, which I think is a position that, again, I don't agree with, but I don't think that it's necessarily anti-Semitic.
Right.
But I do think that there are places that they've gone that do venture into the realm of anti-Semitism. So, for instance, I think that if protest against the war ends up calling Hillel centers on campus arms of genocide and worthy of getting removed from campus, I would argue that begins to extend into anti-Semitism, because you're basically saying they need that Jewish centers of worship should be removed from campus. And we never ask that of other religious groups on campus. I would say that the social shunning of Israelis extends into anti-Semitism, because if you're born in Israel, that's just an accident of birth. There's nothing you could do to shape where you were born. And so to say that a person who comes from Israel is inherently bad and deserves to be cut out of a community, that to me ventures into anti-Semitism. For groups on campus to adopt a position where you need to take a litmus test in order to join, say, the gardening club or the mariachi band, that you subscribe to a certain political point of view on Israel, that to me ventures into anti-Semitism, because these are not tests that we impose on other groups.
How about, on October 7th, when even while the Hamas slaughter was going on in Israel, and they were killing 1,200 Israelis and raping and kidnapping babies, and that on both campuses, on Harvard and Columbia, there were demonstrations saying that Israel was responsible for this.
Right. There were statements that student groups put out both places that said that Israel was responsible for the massacres that happened on October 7th. That to me is a reprehensible position. And I think probably could fairly be
put in
the bucket of anti-Semitism, because it's essentially saying that people deserve to be slaughtered because of their nationality, that there's a justification for their slaughter. And we don't argue that in other contexts.
And was that condemned? That I guess Claudine Gay, who was the president of Harvard at the time, did not immediately condemn that demonstration.
It was a statement, and she didn't. And there was another accusation that was lobbed against Harvard, which was that Harvard tends to comment on, or had commented in the past on, Russia's invasion of Ukraine or the death of George Floyd, but it was kind of silent. It was silent about the atrocities of October 7th. And to me, this isn't the biggest deal in the world. And I don't think universities should be commenting on every event that happens in the world. But there was this expectation that Harvard would comment on every event happening in the world. And so a lot of Jewish students and Jewish alumni felt aggrieved by Harvard's silence.
Let's talk about, again, what's going on in Gaza. How can this be addressed?
I mean, the simplest way for it to be addressed, in my opinion, is to flood Gaza with as much aid and food as possible.
Does that mean bringing the UN back in?
It absolutely means bringing the UN back in. Israelis have a lot of distaste for the United Nations, and it's not without reason that the United Nations, in addition to the hostile resolutions which have passed through the General Assembly, since the Zionism is racism debates of the 1970s, the United Nations played a role in helping to govern Gaza ever since the 1950s, I believe. And in the course of co-governing Gaza, especially during this period where Hamas was in charge of the Gaza Strip, in the schools that it ran, it had textbooks that glorified violent resistance to Israel. On October 7th, there were 12 employees reportedly from the UN agency in Gaza who were involved in the attack. So I understand why Israelis feel animosity towards the UN. But on the other hand, the network that the UN has of bakeries, community kitchens, the warehouses that they have, the aid distribution networks that they have, and the trust that they have within the Gaza Strip means that they are the indispensable purveyor of aid. And so just to rely on this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation while blithely cutting out the UN, to me, is just to doom Gaza to mass hunger.
Let's back up just a little bit, just into how we got this in March, which was completely withholding food for a month. What possessed Netanyahu? And is this the influence of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, his right-wing partners in his coalition?
Yeah, it is. It is the influence of those two guys. It was kind of insane for Israel to go to war with a cabinet that featured Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, because they are Jewish supremacists. They are people who have authoritarian points of view. They are people who, if you were to just take their statements and have them represent the entirety of Israel, you would have no question making the case that Israel was engaged in genocide. That these two guys really are evil, and their view of Palestinians, in my view, is wicked and reprehensible. And Netanyahu keeps them in his cabinet in order to prevent his coalition from falling. And his selfishness in doing so really does put Israel in a position where it's pursuing terrible policies. There were legitimate arguments that they were making about food, not, in my opinion, that should have justified a policy of deprivation, but they were arguing that Hamas was leveraging food in order to enhance itself.
There's been controversy about how, to what extent that was happening, right?
Yeah, I don't believe that it was happening at scale based on everything I've read and people that I talk to. There was this argument that Hamas was looting warehouses and trucks in order to resell food itself on a black market. I mean, I think it's more indisputable to say that Hamas would collect taxes on food that was sold at markets in Gaza, because Hamas is the de facto
government.
But this is the ludicrous thing, is that Israel was trying to separate food going to civilians from food going to Hamas, but you can't separate Hamas from the rest of society in Gaza. That's implausible, and that type of thinking has the disastrous consequences that we've seen.
How many Gazans have died thus far in this war? Is about 60,000? Is that?
That's about right. Yeah.
And about a third are children. Is that right? Or a little less?
I believe that's right.
Yeah. And if you think of those numbers, that's just atrocious.
Yeah. It's staggering.
Yeah.
It's staggering.
And does that make you look at some of the anti-Semitism on these campuses differently at all?
No, I think that I understand and I sympathize with the passion of protesters. And again, I do not think that most kids who are protesting on campus against these policies, against this war, are anti-Semitic.
In fact, some are Jewish, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I believe that they're sincerely howling about something that they wish they had some power to stop. I mean, I think that there are probably better ways for them to protest. Like, I don't know if protesting Harvard and Columbia themselves as institutions would do anything necessarily to stop this war. They're, you know, those are protests, in my view, that would be better targeted at the U.S. government or against Israel. But, you know, the nature of the way that our society functions and the nature of the modern American university is that it's just this tendency that people have to protest the thing closest at hand, even if there's nothing that Harvard or Columbia could do in the world to stop this war.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Frank Foer. Hey, everybody. We got a new sponsor, Ollie, a tasty and nutritious food for your dog. And the Ollie folks sent Peter a couple weeks of the product for his dog, Nellie, and Nellie loves it. Peter, tell us about Nellie.
You met her once. She's kind of a bigger girl. She's a kind of a bigger dog.
And she loves Ollie.
But she loves Ollie. She loves Ollie, Al. She gets so excited when it's breakfast time, when it's dinner time. She waits by her bowl, and she licks the bowl clean. She's never done that before.
She just gobbles it up.
She gobbles it up. She has a routine where she'll eat her Ollie for dinner, and then we'll go for a walk, and she has such a pep in her step.
Now, it says here that they have 5 protein pack recipes. What are those meals like?
She loves them. In fact, this morning she had the fresh turkey with blueberries.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good.
They also have things like fresh beef with sweet potatoes. She loves that one too.
So you're going to be sticking with Ollie.
We're sticking with Ollie. We got a sample pack to try, and we're going to continue doing it. She loves it.
So we'll keep tracking how Nellie's doing. How's that?
Yeah, that's a great idea. And by the way, if you are a member of Ollie, you can keep track of your pet's health with their digital screenings that they do.
Really?
You can take pictures of your dog and upload it, and they will get back to you with a weight screening or a dental screening or even a digestion screening just based on photos that you upload to Ollie.
Fantastic. Well, thanks. You know, dogs deserve the best, and that means fresh, healthy food. So head to ollie.com/franken, tell them all about your dog, and use code Franken to get 60% off your welcome kit when you subscribe today. Plus, they offer a happiness guarantee on the first box. If you're not completely satisfied, you'll get your money back. That's Ollie, OLLIE.com/Franken, and enter code Franken to get 60% off your first box. And we are back with Frank Ford. Well, let's talk about some of your writing in these three articles, about Columbia, where you went to school, and the anti-Semitism there that seemed to become part of the culture, and at Harvard.
Hey, before you, I just want to, I think you're pushing on something important. I just want to dwell on it a little bit longer, which is, it's possible that two things could be true simultaneously, even if there is tension between them. I mean, okay. it's possible that Israel's war can be criticized, and it's possible that it could be criticized in extreme ways. And it's possible that people who are morally justified in their criticisms can veer into behavior that takes them into places that's not morally justified. And that there are two things that people in the world, you know, that we need to be concerned about. One is about the prosecution of the war itself. And then the second is, we exist within communities and in a polity and within a culture. And, you know, just because there's something we don't like or we might consider evil over there, it doesn't mean that we should stop worrying about how we talk about it and how we treat each other over here.
Well, your articles are about sort of the illiberalism on college campuses.
Yes.
Two of them on Columbia and one on Harvard. And there are instances that kind of illustrate what you're talking about. Can we go into a couple of them? Or
sure.
There is this professor who was born in Israel. His name was Avi Shalim, and he had a class on modern Israel, right?
Right. He was teaching a class at Columbia on the foundations of modern Israel, and his goal was to try to view the origins of this conflict that we're now experiencing, both from both sides, to understand it critically from both sides, to engage with both sides of the argument in the most empathetic and sincere sort of way. He's somebody who comes from the left himself. He's a believer in peace processes, etc.
Now, this is after October 7th. This is
Well after. It's more than a year after. He's trying to explain the expectations for the class, the seminar. And he's in the middle of doing this, and protesters enter his class and accuse him of being an accessory to genocide, and say that his class is an example of how Columbia is apologizing for genocide. It's complicit in genocide. And, you know, just to spell it out, the idea that a teacher who's trying to, who just because he comes from Israel and just because he's trying to explain the conflict in this balanced sort of way, it's ludicrous to accuse him of
the structure of the whole course is presenting both sides.
Exactly. It's ludicrous to explain that process of trying to of mutual understanding, to equate that with genocide.
And he invites them to sit down and listen to the class.
Yes. And they've refused to do that. And they record themselves and they distribute all sorts of images of kids dying in Gaza. You know, it's hard to describe the attack on him as anything other than anti-Semitic, because it's making all sorts of assumptions about what he believes and what he's teaching based on where he comes from.
There's a whole bunch of instances like this that you document in both Harvard and Columbia. The Trump administration loves this, right?
I'm not sure they love my articles per se, but I think that the Trump administration has seized on these examples of anti-Semitism, and they have inflated them, and they've used them as a pretext for mounting really the most dangerous assault on American higher education in its recent history.
And they go after both institutions. They go after now the president of Harvard, Claudine Gay, had a bad run of this, right?
That's right. So even long before the Trump administration came around, she was pushed out of her job at Harvard. She resigned January 2024 because she testified before Congress and was asked a question by Elise Stefanik, the Trump-supporting congresswoman from New York, about whether calls for genocide of Jews constituted harassment. And Claudine Gay said it depends what the context is. And that phrase became instantly infamous. And it wasn't even so much the substance of her answer as it was kind of the inertness and lack of emotional intelligence or emotional response that she supplied.
She was testifying with the president of MIT and the president of Pennsylvania. None of them did particularly well, but this stood out.
It stood out.
Not long after she had to leave, right?
Yeah. By the end of December, she was basically pushed out.
And Alan Garber becomes the president. He's the provost. Can you talk about him a little bit?
Yeah. Alan Garber had been the provost, which is the chief academic officer of Harvard for 12 years. And he was in some ways an anonymous academic bureaucrat to much of the outside world. When Claudine Gay testified before Congress, he was sitting in back of her. He was kind of this accidental president of Harvard that when Gay was appointed to that job, he told Harvard that he was on his way out, that he was going to retire, that he would help smooth the transition to the next administration. And then Gay gets pushed out and Harvard turns to Alan Garber at this stage and says, you need to be the interim president of this school because we're in crisis right now and we need some sort of steady, stabilizing hand at the helm.
He's a pretty remarkable guy. He's a doctor, right?
Mm-hmm.
He got his doctor's degree where, at Stanford?
At Stanford, yes.
But he's also a scientist.
He's an economist.
Okay. He got his PhD at Harvard.
Exactly. And then he melded those two and became one of the leading healthcare economists in the nation.
And he did that at Stanford then came back to Harvard at a certain point.
Yeah, that's
right. To be the provost.
That's right.
And so now suddenly he's thrust into this job of being president. Turns out he does a pretty fantastic job.
He does. And what he does is that he takes this moment of crisis and he uses it as an opportunity to begin to push forward some reforms that he thought that were badly needed in the institution. And primarily he's addressing a bucket of problems that he describes as illiberalism on campus. And some of this ends up tracing back to anti-Semitism, but more fundamentally, what he's delving into is that when he went to Harvard, he was an undergraduate there, he felt as if, and this may be totally nostalgic and invented history, but he felt as if it was possible to have really difficult conversations across political difference.
Well, we talked about this a little bit, and I don't usually like to raise it. I went to Harvard. It sounds, self-serving or something. But we were, the school was mainly men and mainly white men and white women. We did have arguments over the war, because there were some SDSers who were more militant, and then there were some of us who thought, you know, we went on strike when they invaded Cambodia and that sort of thing. But I didn't think that on campus there were a tremendous amount of disagreement.
Right. When, as he remembers it, which is maybe different.
And he's younger than me. He's 4 years younger. May have changed, you know?
Yeah. Well, those were tumultuous times when things were changing. The political climate kept shifting probably with every year. And so he remembers that it was possible to have these conversations. And as he's provost, he has this sense that Harvard is asleep at the wheel. It's letting itself down.
People shy away from controversial discussions is basically exactly what's happening on campus.
It's becoming a political monoculture, mm-hmm. in his view, and that it means that the school is hiring people who think alike. And so he commissions a couple of task forces to look at this, and they survey the students and they survey the faculty, and it turns out that both students and faculty largely agree with them, that there's a huge portion of the student body that believes that it can't have difficult subjects, and that kids are self-censoring themselves. And faculty who are being caricatured as being these radical leftists actually agree with Garber, that there's this silent majority on the faculty that believes that they wish that they were being challenged more by their students. And they feel that students are performing for them when they debate in class, or when they hand in papers, that they're writing with an eye to conforming what they expect the views of their professors are in order to get the highest grade.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Let's tell about this professor. I found this interesting. This Professor Joseph Massad.
Yes.
Was a great scholar, right? But bullied Jewish students.
I don't know if I would describe him necessarily as a great scholar, but we're at Columbia right now, and he's somebody who's teaching Middle East studies. And at Columbia, there's this legacy of one of the greatest professors in the history of the school is a literary critic named Edward Said, who was
That's who I'm confusing him.
Right,
okay.
Who was born in Jerusalem and wrote the landmark book Orientalism, which was a critique of the way that Middle Eastern studies had been practiced in American and British universities. And inherent in this critique was that these departments tended to hire white guys who either romanticized the Arab or demonized the Arab, and that it was incumbent on Middle Eastern studies to reform itself by hiring people who came from the region, which is a fair enough critique. Mm-hmm. But he left this legacy because he was an activist and who was very passionate about the Palestinian cause, and ended up hiring protégés who kind of lacked his savoir-faire and lacked some of his nuance, and who were passionate activists. And the problem when you bring passionate activism into the class is that there's this real possibility, and especially on the subject of something like the Middle East, that not everybody in the classroom is going to agree. And so it's incumbent upon professors to try to not demonize students who disagree with them, because that is a flexing of their power. That is that's deeply imbalanced in the classroom, and it's antithetical to the whole enterprise of academic pedagogy, where you're not supposed to bully your students into agreeing with you. You're supposed to provide them with tools to be able to think for themselves. And there are lots of allegations about Mossad that he was somebody who treated students who disagreed with him with deep hostility and made them feel as if there was no place for them in his class.
And how did he characterize October 7th?
I'm paraphrasing here, but he described it as kind of this awesome event that had happened. I'm not paraphrasing. I think he did use the term.
Yes, that's awesome. The word. Yeah.
Yeah.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
You hear that? That's the sound of Pepsi Zero Sugar, the better tasting, more refreshing Zero Sugar Cola. Listen to that endless pour. Pure refreshment. If it sounds this good, just imagine how it tastes. Oh yeah, so good. Pepsi Zero Sugar. Let your taste decide.
Hi, it's Jenny and Bill, and we're the husband and wife team behind Simple Bath and Kitchen. And yes, we've lived through our own remodeling disasters.
One involved a jackhammer in a flooded laundry room. Ask me later.
Yes, I remember, Bill. That's why we built a company focused on beautiful results without the drama. No sales games, just a process we want in our own home.
Because let's be honest, remodeling should make life better, not messier.
Get started today at simplebathandkitchen.com or call us at 614-888-BATH.
So Garber is now becomes the president after Claudine Gay sort of flames out. And how does he approach it?
So he begins to embark on a series of reforms in order to combat the problem that he diagnosed. So one of the reforms is that rather than being in this position that Claudine Gay was in, where she was forced to comment on public events, even when there was no consensus, he passes a new policy that says that essentially Harvard is going to remain institutionally neutral when it comes to events that have nothing to do with the school itself. And that's a way of creating space in these debates, because when the school itself says we're on Russia's side, Ukraine's side of the Russian war, it becomes an institutional position, and it seems to suggest that there's no disagreeing with that position. And that's part of trying to change the culture of the institution. He starts these task forces to look into the problems of illiberalism in the classroom. But mostly he's stuck dealing with the fact that the protests are still engulfing the school, that they're driving away some of Harvard's biggest donors, and it's making it very difficult for the school to go about doing the essential thing that the school
does. There's an encampment in the yard.
Exactly, which began in April of 2024 and became an issue for Harvard because
the commencement was going to be is in the yard, and they were taking over that territory.
Exactly. And he gets to a point where he's about to send in the police to clear out the encampment, which would have been something that would have, we saw what happened at Columbia when the police were brought in. It produced these terrible battles. It resulted in arrest. It ended up just driving the school further apart. It undermined the president of the school, Manoush Shafiq, who was then ousted after that. And I think there's a high likelihood that Garber would have at the very least faced a vote of no confidence if he'd brought in the police. But I think it would have likely endangered his presidency. And at that stage, he was just the interim president of Harvard. And he sends a last ditch message to the protesters in the encampment and says that he would expedite justice for them, that they would have disciplinary proceedings that would happen extremely quickly. They wouldn't have this hovering over them, which I think they interpreted as some gesture towards possibly receiving amnesty, which he says he never promised them. But his message to them comes at a moment when they were, you know, basically ready to depart, and he gave them a way in which they could honorably depart the scene. And so Harvard ends up averting the scenes that Columbia experienced, and it ends up being this moment that basically allows the corporation, which is the equivalent of Harvard's board, to decide that he's their guy. So they lift the interim tag from him and make him the full president.
But at the commencement, the 13 of them are not allowed to pick up their diplomas.
Yes. And he gets roundly booed, and the faculty is indeed upset with him, which in a way reinforced his credibility, which was that he looked to the eyes of the corporation and the eyes of a lot of donors and maybe to the broader eyes of society as if he'd taken a firm stand against chaos and disorder on campus.
And the big donors, and you describe a big meeting of big donors and important people there, and how he handled himself, and they just went, oh, we don't have to have another president. He's our guy.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, tell me about his manner. I mean, it seems like this is a pretty cool guy.
Well,
you got to meet with him, right? You got to meet with him at his house.
Yeah, I met with him a couple times. I don't know if I would call him a cool guy.
Okay.
I would call him a very academically rigorous guy. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I meant
Al, cool temperamentally.
Your definition of cool, Al, may be different than cool temperamentally, in that he's kind of got a clinical physician's demeanor, that he's somebody who is capable of listening attentively and empathetically to people who disagree with him. And he was involved in hiring the tenure process at the school, where he sat on the committees that were formed to review tenure. So he played a role in hiring a lot of the faculty at Harvard, which meant that he had this reservoir of goodwill that allowed him to do difficult things and to stake out tough positions.
And tell about his background. I mean, he's Jewish.
He's Jewish. He comes from Rock Island, Illinois, part of the Quad Cities. He grew up, his dad was a liquor store owner who didn't go to college, but his dad was culturally aspirational. He played violin in the local orchestra. And when he grew up, maestros who would come to town would come to his house for dinner and for parties. And so he was able to meet them, and he had this reverence for genius.
Yitzhak Perlman came to his house.
Yes, the likes of Yitzhak Perlman, Vladimir Ashkenazi. And when he comes to Harvard, he has kind of the same sense of awe and reverence for genius. And that's part of the reason why he falls under the spell of the economics department, because Harvard's economics department was stacked with all sorts of future Nobel Prize winners. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the interesting thing about him is that there's so many people who preach open-mindedness who are actually very closed-minded people, and that their temperaments are didactic and their styles are bombastic. And he's not like that. I mean, he really is a genuinely open-minded guy.
So he's a perfect leader at this time. Now, of course, Trump and his administration come after him and Columbia. And they're looking at this opportunity. They hate liberal colleges and think that this is a big problem in America. And they're going to punish them.
They're going to punish them. And Columbia gets hit first. And its response is, rather than taking the administration to court or going to war with the administration, their instinct is to say, okay, you've presented us with these demands. Here's what we're reasonably doing to meet these demands, and let's call this whole thing off. And so what Columbia did was more in line with the law firms who rushed to cut a deal with Trump.
Right.
Harvard takes a different approach. I mean, they were interested in negotiating with the Trump administration, but when they get walloped with the list of demands that the Trump administration...
What was the first one? How much in research were they going to take away from them?
Well, so the administration threatened to take away $9
billion. $9 billion.
Yeah, which is a little bit of an inflated figure, but it would have had taken away probably about 10 to 15% of Harvard's budget annually and would have just had the effect of, and it did have the effect, and it is having the effect of crushing a lot of the most important projects that Harvard is engaged in, whether it's dealing with pediatric AIDS or...
Yeah, pediatric AIDS, that has a lot to do with anti-Semitism.
Yeah, exactly. Various nuclear physics projects that they're doing that would be very helpful to the Defense Department.
And all of this research, this university research, is the engine of our prosperity.
Yes, it is. And one of the things is that you can't just turn it off and turn it on. That when you're engaged in a study where you're collecting data, you can't just say, all right, we're going to shut this down for 2 weeks and then pick it up. Because whatever happens in that 2 weeks when you're not allowed to do that research is substantively important for you to be able to interpret your results. And so the mere fact of cutting this off in the short term ends up having a devastating impact on a lot of these studies.
And the administration is relishing this. Now, we're recording this on Monday because you're about to leave town. So we got you in today. And by the time this drops on a Sunday, maybe Harvard will have settled.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
But it's a possibility. So the Harvard Crimson quoted Alan Garber as having told Harvard faculty that they're not going to pay $500 million to the administration. So, and that they're not close to a settlement with the administration.
Okay. That's good, I guess. But the administration relishes this, and Secretary of Education, this is all about attacking kind of liberal academia.
It's about attacking liberal academia, but I think if we step back, they're attacking other things as well. I mean, last week on Friday, they fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
That was hilarious.
Hilarious? Yeah, and terrifying.
I mean, terrifying as well, but basically she gave a certain amount for the preliminary report on how many jobs were created, and it turned out that the real number was a lot less, and that happens all the time. And she put that out, and Trump didn't like the lower number and just fired her.
Exactly. And so the idea that there is such a thing as objective data is something that the administration doesn't like. They want to believe that anything that disagrees with their policy or their priors is rigged, creating the sense that the whole process.
This is the first time this has ever happened, right? Yeah, I mean, right. This is a new one.
So the idea that there is no objective knowledge, that it's all rigged by people who have bias is it helps explain how they're destroying all of these bastions of knowledge and research within the government, but also why they're going after the universities, which exist to produce knowledge that is objective. And then secondly, it's a form of class warfare that the administration is engaged in, where they're going after what they call the professional managerial class, which is their class enemy, and they're trying to beat into submissions. It's knowledge workers of all sorts. It's not just university professors. It's government bureaucrats, it's lawyers, it's teachers, it's Hollywood. These are people that they view as an enemy part of the population that needs to be brought under submission.
They want to put a hold on foreign students from Harvard, right?
Yes, and Harvard has battled them back in court, and whenever this question comes before a judge, they win.
But is this just the fact that the administration can cause them more trouble and continue to cause them more trouble than they can possibly handle?
Yes, I think that's the administration's theory of the case, is that they have so much power, they have so many tools at their disposal that they can launch a percussive assault on Harvard, which they have done ever since Harvard began resisting. And at a certain point, they'll make the cost so high to Harvard that they'll have no choice but to agree to what the administration wants.
And that's where the $500 million was.
Yes.
So if Harvard has to do that, then...
It's even worse than that. It's worse than that. The $500 million, the $200 million that Columbia, $220 million that Columbia ended up paying, that's extortion.
Mm-hmm.
But what the administration's trying to do is ultimately gain a toehold for quashing academic freedom and exerting control over the actual teaching that happens in institutions. Mm-hmm. And so at Columbia... They placed, I may not like Columbia's Middle East Studies department and some of the things that they teach, but I believe that they have the freedom to teach them and that the state should not be involved in setting the parameters for what gets taught in a Columbia department. But unfortunately, Columbia has volunteered.
Ceded this authority?
Voluntarily ceded that authority. So they agreed that there would be a provost who would be appointed to oversee these departments so that they are neutral in a way that would please a monitor who has been installed, agreed to both by Columbia and the government to look over Columbia's shoulder to make sure that they're doing all the things that they told the government that they would do. And to me, this is
very dangerous.
This is the surrender, the beginning of the surrender of academic freedom.
Mm-hmm. Oh boy.
Oh boy.
Well, your new article is just hit the Atlantic, Israel's Last Chance, and I would recommend all of your recent articles on Harvard and Columbia. Where does this go?
Well, let's see what Harvard does, because I think that Harvard, when the government cut the deal with Columbia, I think its intention was to create a template that it could then apply to every other university in the country, that they would make some accusation. It might not be anti-Semitism. It might be something else. And they'd say, okay, now let's settle. And they would ask for some version of the monitor that they imposed on Columbia and some version of the expense that they're extracting from Columbia.
Where does that money go? Where does Columbia's money go? I mean,
it goes to the Treasury.
Oh, it just goes to the Treasury.
Yeah.
Okay, it doesn't go to some pet project of Trump's.
No, in that regard, it's different than the law firms.
Right.
But I think by fighting, Harvard can reshape whatever that template is. And it's my hope that Harvard resists the imposition of a government monitor, because I don't think we want what Columbia has becoming the basis for how universities are governed across the nation.
Now, in the meantime, are the foreign students going to be able to go to Harvard this year?
Right now they can, but there's so much uncertainty clouding their future that I don't know if they'll come.
Right.
I don't know if they'll come. If I was advising a foreign student to come, a friend to come, about whether they should send their kid to the United States, I think I would say, as a matter of principle, you should do it. But there are all sorts of complexities, and we've seen kids get ripped off of these campuses. You know, I think that, you know, again, whatever my problems are with the demonstrators on campus, I don't think that, you know, ICE agents should not be picking up kids based on op-eds that they have written. That's that to me is fundamentally un-American and scary as hell.
But a foreign student has the right. They're on a visa or something like that.
Yeah.
So they have the right to be there, but they're not going to be picked up and yanked out and put in a, held in some prison down in Louisiana.
I mean, unfortunately, we've seen that happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Frank.
Thanks, Al.
Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments. River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.